Rectamol, Craig H. Nakamura, Catherine P. Leonard, residing. Case number 26784, State of Hawaii versus Shane Mark. Dwight C.H. Lum for appellant, Don Fudo for appellee.
Morning, counsel, would you move?
Where you are?
All right, Mr. Lum, you are the appellant, and I understand you reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, is that correct?
If it pleases the court, Your Honor, yes.
Very well, then, now please proceed.
Thank you very much.
Members of the Honorable Court, going to the circumstances of the case, I think that we have to set the context, first of all, that it was not just one trial, there were two consolidated trials concerning Mr. Moore. And at both trials, we had the prosecution claiming that Mr. Moore knew that the person in Maxie Robbins were police officers. However, in both cases, the first trial and the second trial, we have the jury decided that the state had not proven that beyond reasonable doubt. In the first case, even though they came back with murder in the second degree, the fact that they came back with murder in the second, they concluded that the state had not proven that fact regarding police officers beyond reasonable doubt. And that's backed up by the evidence, because the Paskett Robbins, you had the impartial eyewitnesses. I mean, the three Baskin Robbins employees were behind the counter, plus you had one of the customers. They never heard the police officers or anybody say, "We're the police, stop, you're under arrest, stop resisting arrest," nothing like that. One of the employees concluded, her belief was that Mr. Mark was in fact being mobbed, being grabbed by these five people, three men, large men, and was going to be robbed. Okay. At the same time, we have inside Baskin-Robbins Mr. Mark's 10-year-old daughter, Shansi, and also his pregnant girlfriend, Leslie Martin. Okay. And that's one of the reasons why he was struggling, not just for himself, but for defense of others, because he believed that if he did not do something, that they would also harm his family members. This is borne out by what happened not just back on February 1st involving John Pico and Denny Paikai, because at that incident, Pico and Paikai had attempted to hijack him when there was supposed to be this exchange for the computer monitor back in the Moanalua Church parking lot.
Let me jump in and ask you. I understand one of your points of error is that the protection of others' instruction was wrong, correct?
Yes.
I had a question on just that area of the law. Now, in the situation in which your defense is you're acting in defense of a third party, isn't a predicate to that that some aggressive action has to be taken toward that third party? And in this case, what evidence, let's start with the parking lot incident involving Pico and Paikai. What evidence was there that Paikai took any aggressive action toward the defendant's girlfriend, who was the party that he claimed that he was acting defensively?
Well, it comes down to what I believe is the essence of the HRS 73305 regarding defense of others, that it's not so much that this other person had to believe they had to defend themselves. It's the subjective belief of the actor that he has to do something to protect the other person,
right,
based on the circumstances.
Subjective belief has to be objectively reasonable. So I guess my question is, well, what evidence in the record is there that it was objectively reasonable for the defendant to believe it was necessary for him to protect his girlfriend from Paikai at the parking lot?
Well, going into a whole litany of things, okay, this was late at night, okay, this was a situation where supposedly they were supposed to meet not just with Pico Paikai, but with Leslie Martin's sister's boyfriend, Kimo, but for some reason, this guy Kimo backed off. So here he is with people he hardly knew, Pico and Paikai, and they were supposed to do this exchange, they show up, okay, and then, first of all, they were expecting to receive the money at that time in exchange for returning the broken monitor. That's not what happened. What the people in Pai Kai was trying to do was getting, pressuring them to go to Kukio Park Terrace. At trial, Mr. Mark testified that, you know, him found Kukio Park Terrace kind of panicked him because he knew his reputation and he thought he might be found.
All right, but we have to focus on the situation at the time the defendant used force, right? And at the time he used force and he shot Pai Kai, at that point, the girlfriend was sitting in the car, the driver's seat in the car. The defendant had already shot at Pico, and Pico had fled the scene. And Pai Kai was hiding behind the car, or in the side of the car, when the defendant reached up and shot him. So at that point, because don't we have to analyze it from, at the point he used force, he used deadly force, at that point, he was justified in acting to defend his girlfriend sitting in the car. So what's your argument as to, at that point, that he had a reasonable belief that his use of deadly force was immediately necessary to protect his girlfriend?
Well, we'll point out that he did not say that he shot at people. He shot into the air and people fled. He expected Pai Kai would also flee, but Pai Kai didn't.
Right,
he went towards the
car. Pico's out of the scene already. He's run away. All right, so he's there with Pai Kai. Pai Kai's hiding behind the car.
Well, no, he's disputing that Pai Kai was hiding.
Well, what evidence
appeared
do you
to
have?
Him that Pai Kai was circling around the car to the side where Leslie Martin was sitting, and it appeared to him that he might be actually going after Leslie Martin, maybe to grab her or do something to her.
Mr. Lund, is there any evidence that Mr. Mark had seen him with a gun or armed in any way?
He did not see him with a gun, but he had heard their threats, and one of the threats from people was, you know, we're going to take everything from you, and he slammed his fist on the car hood for emphasis. Also, we need to point out, again, Mr. Mark was 5'6", 150 pounds. These guys were close to 6 feet, clearly outweighed him. And if he did not do something to defend himself and Leslie Martin at that time, there was a good chance that they would either one of them or both of them would suffer serious
bodily injury. How far away from the driver's side door was Pai Kai shot?
I don't have the track in front of me, but he was close to the vehicle. As I said, according to Ms. Markford, he was certainly around that side.
Right, but maybe you can see, based upon the record, what is the relationship, location of Pai Kai vis-a-vis the defendant and at the time that he shot?
I believe that Pai Kai was around the front area near the headlight area from the front of the vehicle.
So which way is he facing?
Well, it appeared that he was facing towards the vehicle, that he was coming around the passenger side where there's Martin.
Well, I thought Martin was sitting in the driver's seat.
Well, once again, I apologize, Your Honor. I can refer to my transcript.
But was there any evidence that Pai Kai, at the moment he was shot, was attempting to open the door, was attempting to threaten the girlfriend in any way? Is there any evidence that any aggressive action was being taken towards the girlfriend at the time Pai Kai was shot?
Not directly towards the girlfriend.
All right, so why is the defendant's belief objectively reasonable? I mean, that's my question. Doesn't, for a defense of others' defense, doesn't the person who's being defended against have to take some affirmative, aggressive action toward that third party before I can jump in and exercise the defense of I'm trying to protect that third party?
So it has its own skin as the objective subjective. If we look at the entire circumstance of what was happening that night, if Mr. Mark had an objective, reasonable belief that he had to do something at that point in time, there doesn't have to be something clearly over an immediate direct threat just towards that person. because, once again, it's the thought that if he himself is injured or incapacitated, there's not going to be any left to...
Mr. Lum, if you would, now, can you go through that same analysis with regard to the incapacitated body?
After he just hits the path at the parking lot recovery first, there was a series of incidents that happened after that that raised the alarm level for Mr. Martin. First of all, he testified that he and Liz Martin were chased by these guys when the truck would occur to him that one of them might have had a weapon, and he thought that people. There's also testimony at the trial from Leslie's uncle, Blaine Roque, that there had been a visit to his apartment by Denny Paikai, and that Paikai was not just looking for Mr. Mark, but was also looking for his Leslie Martin. And the warning that Mr. Mark received, I guess indirectly through Blaine Roque talking to Leslie Martin, was that he had to not just look out for himself, but for Leslie and anybody close to him. Okay, this ties in with also what happened just a few days before, because he was making arrangements with the attorney Miles Briner to try to turn himself in before the incident. However, one of the things he said he wanted to make sure about was that Leslie and the baby would be safe first, because he knew once he was in custody, he would not be there to protect them. So all this flows into what happened at the Baskin Robbins in March of 2003. At that point in time, he was not really expecting trouble. He was going there just to visit with Shansi and Shansi's mother and have one last visit with them before he had to turn himself in. He was thinking he'd do this and then he'd take care of things. However, that's not what happened. Okay, once again, the jury did not believe that these persons identified themselves as police officers, and therefore the circumstance for Mr. Mark was that he's grabbed by people he does not know. One of them is grabbing into his pockets, and he has his pregnant girlfriend there, Leslie Martin, who right at that moment in time was helping him to put the necklace and the earrings.
Is there any evidence that the officers took any aggressive action toward Martin or the defendant's daughter at the Baskin Robbins?
Well, there was the struggle, and according to Mr. Mark, it felt like they were pushing him.
Is there any indication that they took any aggressive action? They took aggressive action toward Mr. Mark, clearly. But what about the... And so he has a self-defense and got a self-defense instruction as to himself. But the question is, what evidence shows that there were any aggressive action toward the wife or the girlfriend such that he had a legitimate protection of others justification defense?
Well, once again, he believed that they were pushing him towards them, and his struggle with them was actually, he believed that to get them away from his daughter and the girlfriend was to go towards the counter. And so it felt to him that they were pushing him towards them, and that it was three persons on top of him, and that he had to get away. So it is clear in his mind that he had to do something.
Assuming he has a subjective belief that these men who are attacking him might also attack his girlfriend and his daughter, why is that subjective belief objectively reasonable? Because you have to meet two things, correct?
Yes.
It seems to me you're arguing that he had a subjective belief that his girlfriend and his daughter were in peril by the situation. My question to you is, well, why, what evidence is there that that subjective belief was objectively reasonable?
Mr. Lum, wasn't Chauncey within an arm's length of both the defendant and the officers when they grabbed him?
Yes, he testified that he was right, as I said, he was right in the process of putting the necklace and the earrings on Chauncey.
So he was touching his daughter when he was grabbed. So he was a young girl, 10 years old, so he's right there. Is that correct?
Yes.
And where was Leslie?
Leslie was close by, because he said he had the earrings and the necklace. He was putting the necklace on Shanxi, and he had handed the earrings to Leslie so Leslie could put the earrings on Shanxi's ears. Point out also that there was testimony not just from Mr. Mark, but from Shanxi's mother, that Shanxi was not feeling well. She had her head down, and I guess it appeared she was sick. She had some stomach ache or something. Once again, this points out something that had to be kept in mind, not just that these were other persons, but that their vulnerability. He had a young girl who was not feeling well, not sick, could not act on her behalf just to protect herself or to run away or get out of the area of danger.
Mr. Lung, what justified the use of deadly force, or more specifically, what would justify the giving of an instruction on the use of deadly force by Shanxi and Ms. Martin in these circumstances? Had the officers drawn their weapons at the time that they approached Mr. Mark or not, according to the record?
According to the record, they had not drawn their weapons, but his belief was that these were boys who were sent by John Pico or Denny Paikai, and that if they did something to him, they would do something to his other family members.
But what's the evidence that there was a threat of deadly force in this circumstance that would justify the use of deadly force in the protection of Shanxi and Ms. Martin?
Well, we believe that under the statute, deadly force is justified not just to protect against, you know, death or, I guess, serious bodily injury, but also against kidnapping. And kidnapping is, under the statute on kidnapping, is pretty broad under Section 707.720.
Well, what steps did the officers take to restrain the girlfriend or the daughter, which is the element necessary for kidnapping?
Well, at that point in time, Mr. Mark could not actually see if they
right.
did
I,
anything.
But can I use deadly force if I think you're going to kidnap someone, or do I have to have evidence that you actually were in the process of? In other words, can you use deadly force because you're concerned that something might happen, or does there have to be more concrete evidence of something actually happening before you can resort to deadly force?
But I would argue that it's not just the fact of being grabbed, but once again, threats that he had received before, warnings he had received before, and believed that these things would escalate, and that if he didn't act immediately, that it would involve harm to Leslie Martin and to Shanxi.
Mr. Lung, just in a nutshell, before we move on to another area of the case, can you explain why you think the instructions were prejudicially erroneous with regard to defense of others?
Well, because the court gave instructions on self-defense, but the one on defense of others, as we pointed out, focuses instead of his subjective belief in having, or objective reasonable subjective belief that he had to protect them, that it turned the focus to the other persons, whether they themselves would themselves have this justifiable use of deadly force defense. What hurts him is that the jury might have somehow thought that, okay, Mr. Martin had the opportunity to maybe retreat because he's reasonably healthy and young and everything. However, if you turn it to the other side, even if he could retreat himself to complete safety, could the other persons, could Leslie Martin and Shanxi retreat to complete safety?
Wasn't the instruction as given that he know that if the defendant knows he can avoid the necessity of such force with complete safety by retreating, doesn't that fairly implicate or suggest that the necessity for force would be the necessity of protecting Shanxi and Ms. Martin, and therefore he didn't have a duty to retreat unless he could obtain their complete safety, which, as I understand it, is your argument of what the law is?
But the way the instruction is written, it once again only refers to his complete safety, not to the others. We think the jury should be instructed to focus also on Leslie Martin's and Shanxi's complete safety also.
How about the conflict issue in terms of the representation by the public defender's office?
And Mr. Lum, when you address the conflict issue, I'd like you to, if you will, go through the timeline of the representations for us. I would specifically like to know, what is the timeline of the public defender's office of Mr. Pico? And then I would also like to know, what is the timeline of the offices representation of Mr. Mark. And is that in this record?
I believe that it was covered in the hearing on the motion that was held before Judge Ahn during the second trial. There was testimony not just from the public defender's office. There was also testimony, I believe, from deputy head Timothy Ho, who testified to how they were assigned and for what periods of time.
Because part of your argument is that the representation was concurrent. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so that's why I'm interested in the timeline.
Okay, as to Mr. Mark, the public defender represented him from his arrest in March of 2003 and continued through the trial in November of 2003 and the second trial in July of 2004. As to John Pico, he was represented by another public defender, Jason Burks. And that his representation of Mr. Pico.
Time's run up, but we're going to allow you to finish this line of questioning.
Perhaps I could reserve this and I can refer to
you. You can go ahead if you'd like to answer the question or you have an answer to the question.
All right.
Maybe you can answer, I don't want to make it harder on you, but maybe you can answer this question.
Yeah.
After the probation of Mr. Pico was revoked, and he was sent to prison, correct?
This was after Mr. Martin's trial, though his probation after the first trial, there was a probation revocation.
Right, and after his probation was revoked, he was sent to prison?
I believe so.
And so his probation was terminated and he was in jail? Is that your understanding of what happened?
My understanding is that he was in jail at the time he testified at the second trial.
So he was no longer under probationary sentence, he was in fact the sentenced defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. According to the testimony at the hearing, the Jason Brooks of the Public Defender's Office represented Mr. Pico on the forgery and drug case from 2001 to 2002.
And then was he on probation at the end of 2002 through 2003, or until he went back to jail?
Yes, they testified that he was represented by a second public defender on the probation revocation in April of 2004.
Okay. Now, is there anything in the record, and I'm sorry, I'll try and finish this up, but is there anything in the record as to actual termination of the attorney-client relationship between Mr. Pico and the public defender's office during the pendency of his probation?
There was no motions to withdraw and no motions to substitute different counsel on his case, so it appeared that public defender remained on his case throughout that entire time.
So they didn't send him a letter saying you're no longer our client, there's no communication to Mr. Pico or from Mr. Pico that they're no longer his counsel?
Not from the record.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Lum, once he's His probation has been revoked and he was then sentenced to prison. Is it your position that the representation by the public defender's office was continuing after that point, or it had ended?
Well, we believe it continued because just because he was sentenced to prison doesn't mean that that ends the representation. There are things such as minimum term hearings for parole board purposes, and there are also the further actual parole hearings before the parole board, and that there's no indication that that type of representation is out until they actually file that.
Is a counsel appointed automatically representing someone in those situations?
Well,
or do they have to be reappointed?
Your Honor, my understanding when the public defender undertakes these kinds of cases that their representation continues throughout until there is some sort of formal withdrawal or there's a bearer's conflict of interest where they refer the case to an outside counsel or a court-appointed attorney.
Is that reflected in the record, Your Honor?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Okay.
Thank you. Why don't we move on now to Mr. Fudo, and we'll hear from you on your rebuttal argument then.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Officer Glenn Gaspar did not die in vain. The jury's verdict validates the fact that Officer Glenn Gaspar died fulfilling his oath to serve and protect the public while he was in the line of duty. I understand what the jury did not find, but I also understand as clearly what the jury did find. Simply put, he was not justified in murdering the officer. It's that simple and it's that clear. With respect to Leslie in the parking lot, defendant admitted, I'm not supposed to do that. Defendant admitted that before he shot Paikai, he could have, quote, got in the car if he wanted to and left. Nothing physically prevented him from getting in the car. With respect to the incident at the ice cream store.
You can't stop you there. Can you tell me from the record what the relative positions of the three individuals were at the time?
Leslie Martin was in the driver's seat. Defendant was next to her outside of the car.
What part of the car?
Right next to the driver's door. And Paikai was evidently coming around toward the headlight when he pointed the gun at him and shot. I need to fast forward for just a moment and go to the ice cream store. And with respect to his daughter, Shansi, the evidence is as clear that there was no justification. She was in no danger, and he was not acting nobly to protect her. If you'd indulge me for maybe 18 seconds. I'm 52 years old and I wear trifocals, and that video did not show that child in any apprehension of any immediate danger. And I've heard danger used loosely, threats used loosely in this proceeding so far this morning, but I'd like to be just a little bit clearer. It's not a danger and it's not a threat of harm. It's the imminent threat of death, serious bodily injury, kidnapping, rape, forcible sodomy. Okay. I'm asking the court to hold defendant to that standard, and I want defense counsel to do what they couldn't do at trial, and that's to identify any evidence that suggests that child or anyone else in there was facing that type of imminent harm. Not some vague apprehension of fear that's probably engendered by a coward shooting unarmed people. The evidence in the record also shows that with respect to the ice cream store, he did not think they were Haikai's boys or Pikoi's boys. In fact, what he actually said...
Evaluating the evidence, don't we have to look at it, especially the necessity for the instruction, don't we have to look at it, the court says, any evidence, it has to be the greatest evidence, but any evidence that would support the defense.
Yeah, I agree. So what is the evidence? Of an imminent threat of death, serious bodily injury, kidnapping, rape, or forcible sodomy. There is none.
Under the circumstances as believed by the defendant.
As he reasonably believed them to be. Was he putting the necklace on the child? No. Unless the video is wrong and no one contests that, the answer is no. The evidence in the record shows that he did not believe they were Pikoi's boys. Pikoi's boys. He did not believe they were Paikai's boys. What he said is he did not know who they were. He thought they were there to rob the ice cream store. He thought they were there to possibly take him from the ice cream store and kill him. Everything was him, 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 him. Not Melissa. Not Leslie. So I agree with you, Your Honor. Had there been that scintilla of evidence, I would have conceded that point on the brief as I did with the extended sentence. However, an officer, a human, was killed. The sanctity of life in this state from 100 years ago doesn't base the justification defense on some vague apprehension of fear.
So, counsel, are you arguing that he was not entitled to the instruction, but you would have conceded the instruction was inadequate if he was entitled to it?
No, I'm not arguing
okay.
that.
Okay. Just wanted to be clear.
No.
What are you arguing then?
I'm arguing that there is no mistake in the instruction that warrants reversing the murder conviction in the first trial for Officer Glenn Gaspar.
Are you saying there was sufficient evidence to give the instruction?
No. There was no evidence to give the instruction.
You're arguing both things, that the court shouldn't have given the instruction in the first place, and the instruction that was given was accurate in any event.
The instruction as given was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
What was wrong about the instruction?
I'm not conceding anything was wrong with the instruction. I believe the instruction conveyed the principles that I believe is now Justice Sokoba said in State versus Neupaset with respect to the merging of protection of others and protection for oneself, and they both apply upon with respect to the application of force when you're defending another. It's on the same terms as if you were defending yourself.
Well, counsel,
that was conveyed.
In the first trial, the instruction that talked about the duty to retreat, or the part of the instruction that talked about the duty to retreat, was drawn from 304. That's the section that relates to self-defense, and wasn't drawn from 305, which is a part of the code that relates to defense of others. So do you see a problem with drawing on principles from the self-defense portion of the statute as opposed to the defense of others portion of the statutes? And evidently the trial court had some concern, because in the second trial, the trial court in fact changed the instruction to track 305.
If I understand the question, I will answer it like this. In quoting from State versus Neupaset at 90 Hawaii, 175, and I quote, an appropriate instruction on the defense of others must interrelate provisions of section 703-305, which is defense of others, and 703-304, which is defense of self. The fact that it didn't have the aspect of 305, defense of others, which would have required Melissa and Leslie to retreat, that didn't hurt the defendant, that helped him. That would have put another layer upon which we would have had to jump through as the state to prove that the defendant was not justified in murdering the police officer. So as was the case in Neupaset when the instruction was given and Justice Sokoba said, one, there was no evidence for the first clause in paragraph 7. And with respect to the parts that weren't given, that only inured to the defendant's benefit. This court must not forget there are two trials. The errors alleged in one don't necessarily relate to the first trial. And unfortunately, maybe the cost of being repetitive, I need to make this court understand in that first trial, there was no errors that forced this court legally to invalidate the conviction for the murder of that officer. 12 reasonable jurors heard his allegation of self-defense and defense of others.
But didn't the instruction in trial one expand the defendant's obligation to retreat over what it was? In other words, in the presence of third party, you don't have to retreat as readily as you do in the defense of yourself. And the instruction in trial number one didn't make that clear because it used the instruction for defense of oneself, which is narrower. In other words, it put the burden on the defendant, a greater burden on the defendant, than it should have.
No? Respectfully, Your Honor, when you first say it didn't make it clear, and then you say it put the burden on the defendant, see, I don't believe it did that. If it wasn't clear, then I will admit to you it wasn't a model of clarity. But inasmuch as it's not a model of clarity, I'm not going to say then that it's so clear that it put the burden on the defendant. And even if it did, for the sake of argument, there was no evidence to support the giving of the instruction. That was a fundamental error here.
Well, that's a different question, though, right? I mean, that's a different question as to whether the instruction as drafted was a legally correct instruction on the law.
Your Honor?
So I want to focus on that, the second part. Was the instruction as drafted a legally correct statement?
To give a legal statement of the law, the instruction that we get from case law at this point is not entirely clear. So it leaves the courts in the precarious position of trying to interrelate the two provisions, self-defense and defense of others. But where Your Honor characterized it as a separate question, unfortunately, my understanding of State versus Nicholas, it's not a separate question. Because when you look at an instruction, and this becomes the untenable position of prosecutors at trial, there is no burden any longer for the defense counsel to properly instruct. It falls all on the court. If you look at the first trial, as well as the second, the prosecutor objected to the giving of the instruction. Defense counsel didn't object to the giving of the instruction. Defense counsel is not counsel seated here today. It's different counsel. You'll notice the conspicuous absence in the defendant's brief of any contention of ineffective assistance of counsel.
But Nichols makes all that irrelevant, right?
It makes it irrelevant, but only to the extent, and this is the second part where I believe it's interrelated. I said, so assuming for the sake of argument, the instruction wasn't the moral of clarity. Under the second part of Nicholas, was it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? To answer that fundamental question, we must go back and we must ask the defendant, like the jurors required him to do at trial, identify for us, where is that evidence of kidnapping, of sodomy, of forcible, of a rape, of serious bodily injury or death, as it relates to Melissa, as it relates to Leslie? His counsel, during the settling of instructions, said, give me just one second, that with respect to Melissa, she wasn't justified in using deadly force. She would not have been justified. With respect to Leslie, if this court has done its characteristic, meticulous, sedulous review of the record, you will notice the glaring absence of anything in defense counsel's closing argument to even suggest that the defendant was acting to protect anyone but himself. I heard from one of the justices, perhaps, that Shane Marks was putting the necklace on the defendant, was touching her. I just didn't see it in the video. And from at the point in time when the video ends, the transcript picks up the scuffle, if you will. Defendant and three unknown men. It was only directed at the defendant. No one is heard to say, no one is heard to testify, Leslie, look out. Sean C., look out.
Mr. Fudo, if I could. Well, first of all, just for the record, the video you showed us was admitted into evidence at trial, correct?
Yeah, actually it was State's Exhibit 89-106.
And this instruction that we're talking about, it also indicated that the defendant had provoked the use of deadly force, that he would not have the defense of others available to him. Now, if you look at Section 305, there's nothing in that section that talks about provocation by the defendant as disabling the defendant from having the ability or being able to rely on the defense of use of force. So how What's your argument as to why the inclusion of that language in the instruction was correct, and if it was error, was it harmless?
I'm not arguing that it was correct or incorrect. What I'm arguing is a case, as Justice Acoba pointed out in Nukaset, that inasmuch as a defendant relying on protection of others, it's on the same terms with respect to the use of deadly force as he would be able to avail himself if he was protecting himself. Whether or not it was artfully crafted, I will not look you in the eye and say it was. But I will look you in the eye and say that it was not harmless error. Because I have not heard a concern from this court yet, or from defendant, or read in the record anything that would suggest it was anything but harmless error. Litigators that have actually gone into trial in this circuit know that things happen during the settling of jury instructions that are unrecorded. Litigators know that it's not uncommon for a trial court to put an instruction in with the caveat, well, let's just be safe. We don't want to get reversed. My job as an appellate counsel is to look at the law. My job is to apply that law to the facts. And I will say again, I will admit I am capable of error, and when I see it clearly, I will concede. But I will not concede where I do not see error. And I have not heard, seen, or read anything to suggest the specific imminent threat that the statute requires before a person, this person, could take another human's life was present. The giving of the instruction was error. His counsel did not rely on that defense during the trial.
I'll just to follow up on this one line. If the instruction or section 305, which governs defense of others, does not disable a defendant from relying on that defense because the defendant provokes the use of deadly force, as 304 does. So we have a very clear difference in the language of the two statutes. Self-defense statute talks about provocation by the defendant as making the defense unavailable. 305 doesn't include any reference at all to provocation. Nevertheless, this court in its instruction on instructing on defense of a third party included language which in effect said the jury could find that the defendant was not entitled to this defense if the defendant had provoked the use of deadly force. So my question to you is, particularly with regard to the parking lot incident, is it not possible that the jury could have rejected the defense of others defense based on this provocation theory, which is not reflected in the statute?
So this is a matter of, I guess, probably people talking, could they have? Is it within the realm of probability? I honestly can't answer that question. I wasn't there. If you were asking me to opine as based on the evidence and the law, and just as, you know, reasonable man on the street, I would say, no. One individual he shot at, he ran away. The other individual, who he knew was not armed, he shot him also. Now, if I'm sitting in that box as 12 reasonable people, so defendant, what you would have us believe is, Pike, I knew you had just shot at Pico runs away. I, Pike, who have no weapon, I see you, defendant, your girlfriend, Russell Kimura, Carley, but what's my camera? Yet I'll be a hero and I'll run to you, an armed person who I know will shoot. No, if you're asking me, am I sitting there? I can't. But I'm not going to try and tell you that there's something I can point to empirically when you ask the question, could it? Anything could happen, and that's why O.J. walked free in the first trial.
The question is whether it was harmless error. If the instruction was incorrect, is it harmless error? And I take it from your argument.
Do you know after just in other words, was there an additional probationary sentence to take place after the defendant got out of jail after being booked? Or once he got out of jail, he's on parole? In other words, is his probationary sentence over once he gets sent to jail on the revocation?
Okay, I understand the question. I just don't know from the facts whether it was a sentence which included the term of imprisonment incident to the probation system, and got out for whatever period of imprisonment, he's still on probation, or as you said, you have the open whatever, and it goes on. It wasn't made clear by the public defender. Imaginations and working in their office wasn't made clear, but what is made clear from the record, at the time of the first trial and the conviction for the murder of Officer Gaspar, the PICO file was closed. It was in a closed file room. They had nothing more to do with it. So if we're looking at the state of conflicts of interest,
I want to talk about a different case, otherwise the Supreme Court, cited by the defense, which is State versus Ritchie. Is that binding precedent? Do we have to follow that case?
Well, Ritchie hasn't been overruled, if that's what you are asking.
Right.
And if it's on point, then I would say it's precedent. As the ICA, I would suspect, yes, it must be followed.
And you don't address his argument at all on the Ritchie case. You say that it was not an abuse of discretion. So are you arguing that Ritchie is inapplicable to this case?
No.
So please explain, because in your answering brief, you don't address his Ritchie argument, you don't respond to it, and so I'm asking you to explain that to me.
Okay, just a moment. I don't believe it's a non-response. I have a limited amount of pages. I understand concurrent representation is a death knell. I understand.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Okay. The holding in Ritchie, as I understand it, is that defense counsel's representation is constitutionally ineffective under the Hawaii Constitution if, one, a relationship giving rise to a conflict of interest existed between defense counsel and his or her clients. So that's the issue of concurrent representation, former representation. That's the factual issue that we were asking appellant about. But then if we find that that relationship exists, the second prong of Ritchie gives an alternative, which is either the relationship adversely affected defense counsel's performance, and you're saying no way, it didn't, because there's no record that defense counsel even knew about the conflict, but the or is, or the client did not consent to the relationship. And that's my concern about the Ritchie case, is that it's either or. And you didn't address the or, and so we've got to get clear on whether the conflict existed.
I don't address the or because the or is not implicated. With respect to your characterization of that existed, the that which must exist before you get to the or is the, what I will call the fatal relationship.
Right.
The court has made clear in Ritchie, as it did in Pitt, as it did in that case, Justice Okoba did in F-R-A-G-I-A-O, those fatal relationships are joint representation of co-defendants, which we do not have here, and it's the second trial only we're talking about, not the murder of Gaspar. The other fatal one is concurrent representation, where the public defender and that specific public defender, Debbie Loy, was represented.
But assume for the purpose of this argument that when the public defender has his name on the pleadings for both clients, that we might consider that representation by a single office. I mean, we don't have any evidence that there was a ethical wall in place, or that the, I mean, your argument is that it's no prejudice because there was no actual breach of confidentiality, but there was also, as I understand it, there was no actual separation of one client's files from the other client's files. They had access. You're saying that they just didn't go look.
No, that's definitely not what I'm saying, and I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. I'm saying that the prohibited relationship as a matter of law did not exist.
Okay, well,
that's number one.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. Please explain that to me, because I'm not sure I got that from your brief.
Because, one, it wasn't a joint representation of co-defendants, if I can be allowed, and two, it wasn't concurrent representation. At best, at worst, it was prior. Your Honor's recollection of the record with respect to the walls, that's actually not what the record reflected. What the record reflected that it was in a closed file room. They had Timothy Ho come in and say that neither of the two joint counsel had any knowledge of even the existence of the file, had not spoken to anyone, had not spoken to prior counsel, and also, according to the rules of professional conduct in this state, what you're saying about the caption, there is no imputed disqualification of an office, of a government office. That's in Rule 1.9. Furthermore, we have federal law from this jurisdiction in the Ninth Circuit. Former Senior Justice Samuel King said he wasn't going to find imputed disqualification of the public federal defenders because one counsel had previously represented another witness. Third of all,
What case is that?
That would be United States versus Judge, with just one moment, at 65 F sub 901, United States of America versus Gwynn Judge. It was authored by Senior District Judge Samuel Penn. On the briefs were Mark Bennett and Michael Levine, the federal public defender, along with Ben Cassidy. That case has not been overruled. That case has been followed. Also, in the case cited, that Frago case, I believe it was Justice Acoba, said also that in Graves versus Maryland, that court did a survey of jurisdictions around the country. They're not going to impute disqualification to government lawyers. So all we have left is the prior representation. In that case, what the judge is supposed to do, what the analysis entails, is determine the first factor of a two-factor test relating to the effectiveness of the cross-examination to determine whether or not there existed a divided loyalty. Under the first factor, what the court did and was required to do was have the evidentiary hearing, determine whether or not Debbie Loy or Miss Marshall had any pecuniary interest. Answer is no.
Okay, but I want to be satisfied on the concurrent representation issue. That's the one that I want to be really clear on when we leave here today. I want to understand when Mr. Pico's representation began and ended with respect to Mr. Mark's representation, because that is the issue that is of concern to me under the Ritchie case.
I appreciate that concern. My evidence, or the evidence that I saw on the record, that Pico's first, and I don't even know what the offense was based on the record, but his first, let's say, involvement with the court, was completed as of 2001. And at that point, he was just on probation. Now, Justice Nakamura asked, do I know how it works in the prosecutor's office where there's specific official letter communications and consensus? The evidence is silent on that. But from the silent director and the steps that were taken, well, we can't assume prejudice because the United States Supreme Court said in Morrison when Sixth Amendment violations are at issue, tailor it to the violation.
But as counsel, but do you read Ritchie as requiring prejudice if there is a concurrent representation?
No, there doesn't have to be actual prejudice.
Okay.
That's a given.
So that's why I'm focusing on whether the record is clear on the concurrence issue or whether it's as
well. Well, the record is clear, Your Honor, that it wasn't concurrent.
Okay.
Concurrent requires this: ongoing representation by a specific defense attorney of the defendant and a prosecution witness or a hostile party. There was and this is what I'm most clear on, and I said to the court in the attorney that I was, none of this came up in the first trial with a conviction of the murder of the officer. So if you look at the United States Supreme Court case, Tyler versus Sullivan, just consistent with Morrison. Said, okay, there was a technical violation, there may have been something, so it's grounds to reverse the conviction. That is not what we do. And Ritchie makes clear that that our courts will listen to the federal precedent on this. I'm not saying it's as in other instances where they'll say it's bound by it, but they do listen. And there is nothing that the defendant has cited that would support the conclusion that there was concurrent or joint. And I candidly admit it, that there may have been prior, but not by these two. And if the court is familiar with the proceeding, the hearing, the separate hearing during the second trial on this motion, defense counsel said, no, my loyalty is not undivided. Yes, I will zealously represent. The court also took additional prophylactic measures of saying from this point on, public defenders, you will not represent PICO. Stuart Fujioka, you will. Moreover, for that particular hearing,
Mr. Fuda, you've come to the end of your time, but as we did with Mr. Lum, we'll continue on for a bit just to be sure we wrap up on this particular issue.
The additional prophylactic measure the court took was also for that particular hearing. It assigned a separate counsel, Keith Shigetomi, to represent defendant just for that hearing in the second trial to make further sure that nothing would happen. In the time, and I thank you for leaving it, please indulge me for one last time. I would like the court to look at what also was in evidence one more time at half speed and see whether at half speed you can see anything that would support the conclusion there was an imminent threat of death, serious bodily injury, kidnapping, forcible sodomy, rape of Melissa or Leslie, please. Necklace, Officer Gaspar's hand. Thank you very much.
Mr. Fudo, just one question to be sure we're clear on the record. You do concede there was error with regard to sentencing in this case and that the case should be remanded for a sentencing proceeding consistent with the Jess case and the Act 1?
Correct. Consistent with Jess and consistent with Act 1.
Very well. Thank you.
Self-defense and defense of others, it doesn't, as I said, just apply to serious bodily injury, but also, of course, the threat of kidnapping. And the kidnapping instruction to me was problematic when I looked at it again, because there are supposed to be several instances where the kidnapping would apply, not just if there's a threat of bodily injury, but also if the person is being restrained for purposes of using them as a shield or as a hostage or to facilitate the commission of a felony. In this case, that part of the instruction was not given. They only gave the parts regarding subsections D and E of 707-720. We believe that kind of limited Mr. Mars's defense, because as the prosecution pointed out, one of the things he thought was the place was being robbed. If he believed that there was going to be a kidnapping where they would restrain either Leslie Martin or Shancy while they robbed the place, that would also come into play as part of the consideration whether there would be a kidnapping.
But this issue you didn't raise in your opening brief, is that right, Mr.
Yes,
Warren?
I concede that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Regarding the concurrent representation issue, I think that what is clear is that what we've cited to Wick's case law is that the way the case that was cited by the prosecution referred to the federal public defenders, But testimony from Timothy Hull regarding the way the state public defender's office works is that you have actually just the one public defender, John Tanaki, and that everybody acts on his behalf. Okay. So it's not separate offices or having ethical Chinese walls between them. You have one office where everybody is supposedly working for the one purpose of serving the defender, Jack Tanaki, for the clients. In this case...
Can I have one question on that? Assuming you're right, that there was an improper concurrent representation in the case. I assume the danger is because there's a concurrent representation of PICO that Mark's lawyer would not be as aggressive in cross-examining PICO. That's the theory of the problem with concurrent representation, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. But in this case, in the second trial, the charges relating to PICO, the jury did not convict on. They hung on this. And the only conviction in the second trial related to the assault on Officer Sung in the ice cream parlor situation. So assuming arguendo that there was an improper conflict, how would that conflict have affected the outcome of the case in terms of the conviction in the separate incident? I'm looking for a harmless error. Well, why isn't it harmless, even assuming you're right, that there was some attorney representation conflict with respect to PICO as a witness? But he wasn't a witness to the Baskin and Robbins incident. So how does that affect the jury's verdict on that particular charge?
Well, PICO's testimony testified at both trials, and PICO's testimony was basically that, you know, that Mr. Mark was the aggressor, that he was not actually trying to do anything or take anything from him, and that he denied making threats or trying to go after him or his girlfriend. It's a matter of the credibility of Mr. Marx's perception of the need to protect himself and the others around him. That's it. You can't say it's harmless error as to how Mr. Pico's testimony might have affected jurors in their thinking of how Mr. Marx perceived what's going to be happening in Baskin Robbins when he's approached by these three strangers.
Counsel, is part of the answer to Judge Nakamura's question because the Ritchie case says so? Because if we assume that and I'm not sure we're there yet because I haven't heard the answer to my question, but if we assume for the moment that there was concurrent jurisdiction and that there's no consent, didn't the Supreme Court tell us in Ritchie that that is constitutionally ineffective assistance?
Yes, we believe that Ritchie should be the controlling case in this situation because actual prejudice is not required.
Okay, now assuming we got there, that's not exactly the question that we're reviewing. We're reviewing whether it was an abuse of the trial court's discretion to deny the motion to withdraw on that basis. And in the brief, the prosecutors argue, well, it wasn't an abuse of discretion under the circumstances. Can you address the abuse of discretion issue?
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding the abuse of discretion, the issue was brought up, as you said, in the middle of the second trial. I think that the way that there was... I guess if you're looking at abuse of discretion, you're looking at whether the court had acted improperly. We think that there were things that the public defender apparently did not do in the second trial. Namely, you know, it wasn't until way close to the end that they found out that PICO did have these prior convictions regarding forgery that could be used to impeach him. After that point in time, we believe that the public defender did not, you know, had still not been shown to fully investigate the case.
What exactly in the record supports that claim, Mr. Lum? In fact, didn't the trial court find in its findings of fact that the public defender was able to do everything ethically possible to defend Mr. Mark despite this issue?
Well, that was the court's conclusion, and we believe that the evidence that was shown, or testimony that was shown at the hearing, doesn't really support it. All it shows is the public defenders was actually pretty lax in finding out this information, not until the last minute. And therefore, we think that the best thing that should have been done was to have them withdraw and have another attorney appointed for Mr. Mark, one who would have fully investigated all aspects of the state's witnesses, prosecution's witnesses, to look into all impeachment-type testimony, because their focus was apparently just on, let's see, presenting Mr. Mark, but not on actually impeaching the state's witnesses until the very end, when this incident was brought out and they brought the motion for a mistrial.
Mr. Lum, does Arici preclude concurrent representation in the context of a government office? In other words, Arici was not the context of a public defender's office, so does it not leave open the issue of whether in the context of a government office, realizing we would have to decide, and in fact, I guess in this case, the trial court did decide that the public defender's office, there could be a separation between the lawyers who were involved in the two matters. Does it not leave open the possibility that in the context of a government office, you could have concurrent representation provided the lawyers are screened off from each other?
Well, Arici did not address that precise issue, but we believe that when you're looking at the rules of professional conduct regarding government offices, that you also have to look at the way a public defender's office is operated. It's not operated at like other government offices, as was shown at the hearing. They all are supposedly operating together, and they're supposed to all be sharing information on not just one case, but on all their cases regarding all their clients.
But in fact, in this case, if they didn't share the information, whether there were procedures to prevent that from happening or not, the fact is, in this case, they didn't share the information. Isn't that what the record shows?
That's what they claim on the record, I guess. And once again, this is brought out after the fact. The thing that is also not really brought out is why, as I said, why didn't they discover all these things before? Why was it brought out only at the end, near the end of the second trial?
So I have one last question, if I may. Going back to the trial court's exercise of her discretion at that point in the case, as you say, you're pretty far along in the second trial, and by then Mr. Pico is already in jail, so his representation might be done. At that point, when the trial court is exercising her discretion, isn't it a reasonable exercise of your discretion to think about what's the prejudice here to the defendant? I mean, at that point on the abuse of discretion issue, isn't that a reasonable consideration?
Not under Arici, because otherwise, why does Arici have as that second part of the analysis whether or not the client agrees to it? And I think that that falls in with the idea that you just cannot have this going on unless it's actually knowingly and voluntarily waived by the two persons who are supposedly involved, the two clients who are supposedly involved in this concurrent representation.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Fudo and Mr. Lum. We thank you for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement and we stand in recess.
All right.